from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, one of the founding fathers of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier, will join us. He has a new book out that's part memoir, part reflection on the beginnings of the technology industry and the state of Silicon Valley. It's called Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. Stay with us for Jaron Lanier on Forum after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It takes a certain kind of mind to become known as the founding father of virtual reality, so it's not surprising that along with that mention, Jaron Lanier is noted to be a scientist as well as an art student, musician, and writer. His earlier books include Who Owns the Future and You Are Not a Gadget, and his new book is called Dawn of Everything. And it is in part a memoir. It also takes us back through a difficult childhood and conveys the resourcefulness that comes from that kind of upbringing. The book also looks closely at the current tech world we live in and at virtual reality and the new technological frontier it presents. And in the book, he explores the bigger questions and tensions between those decrying how technology is stealing our lives out from under us to the technology utopians who embrace it all. And welcome back to the program, Jaron. Good to have you here.
Always lovely to be here.
Well, you know, you are called the father of virtual reality, the founder of virtual reality, the man who coined virtual reality. Let's get all that straight. I mean, how much of that mantle is actually yours?
Yeah, what I say in the book is it depends if you believe the mother of virtual reality. I mean, the first headset for VR was made by Ivan Sutherland, who's also the great founder of computer graphics and interactive interfaces. And Ivan's still with us. He's living up in Oregon. And in a way, he might deserve the title. But actually, a lot of people have contributed. And
you had the first startup, which I always also mention apropos, started up in 1984.
Yeah, that's right. I had the first startup, and we sold the first products. And also, you know, it depends what you think virtual reality is. Originally, the term virtual reality was supposed to mean the social version of virtual worlds. And that I probably am the father of, because we made the first social version with avatars and multiple people. And we also made the first commercial stuff. But virtual reality changed from that specialized use to being much broader. So I don't know anymore. Who knows?
Well, you've got 51 definitions in your book.
Yeah.
I mean, no less. But there's also that you kind of intimated. There's that distinction that people make appropriately between the industrial side of it and the personal side.
Yeah, there really are these different sides of virtual reality. And for me, both have been kind of ecstatic and really wonderful. On the industrial side, I had the great honor to participate in making some of the earliest applications that continue to this day. And especially, I'll tell you a story. A long time ago, I collaborated with somebody else from the little company we started named Dan Lasko, and then a professor of medicine from Stanford named Joe Rosen, and we made the first surgical simulator. And that blossomed and turned into a technology that's much more evolved and is used all the time. A student of a student of Joe's was a surgeon who performed the primary cancer operations on my wife in the last couple of years, which were successful. And he trained in a system that was a descendant of this thing we built so long ago in the 80s. And so it came around, you know. And so I don't know how often you get to live long enough to see your work come back and really help your life. But it's been very fulfilling.
Yeah, what a terrific feeling. And yeah. Especially so close to home. Early on in the book, you say, never has a medium been so potent for beauty and so vulnerable to creepiness. Virtual reality will test us. It will amplify our character more than any other media ever have.
Yeah, so it's true. On the beautiful side, I mean, there are things you can do with virtual reality you really cannot do with any other medium. You can... Oh, God. One thing you can do is you can experience changing absolutely everything. You can change your body into that of some animal or some fantasy alien. You can change everything about the world. But the fact that you're still floating there highlights the existence of your own consciousness. And it's the only digital interface that does that, that proves that you're real. I mean, most of the digital designs kind of give the opposite message. You're talking to some robot and you start to think, well, me and the robot are similar. We're just mechanism. But with virtual reality, you realize there's something magical and special in you. And I love that. And then on the creepy side, virtual reality is the ultimate implementation of a Skinner box or a behaviorist device to modify how people think and behave without them realizing it. The two go hand in hand, unfortunately. So hypothetically, a world in which everybody's in virtuality is a world in which everyone's controlled. And that's been portrayed in science fiction for a long time, like in the Matrix movies.
Yeah, and in your book, you even go back to Norbert Wiener, who warned us about the internet, in effect, in terms of behaviorism. I mean, the idea that there are a lot of people cooking up ways to, I guess Sean Parker even said to you, yeah, we did it. You know, we cooked up ways to get people addicted.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I think when people like Sean are starting to come clean about this stuff, it's a very good sign. It's showing that a conscience is waking up in Silicon Valley and that we have a heart. And we need some more of it, but I think it's a really healthy development.
Well, let's talk about your development, because you go into your own personal history in the book, and it's really, in some ways, I choose this word selectively, but a somewhat traumatic one, really. I mean, you grew up in a kind of wonderful place in New Mexico where you had a couple of cultures that you could choose from on a daily basis. It wasn't like, you know, having to worry about going over the border or the border coming over you. It was all very clean in many ways, nostalgic about it, I know, but a lot of difficulty in terms of, your mother being ill and dying and your father, you went through some tough times.
Yeah, well, it's a funny part of what I'm trying to explore in the book is how traumas pass between generations and then how they affect your life as you grow up. So my mother survived a concentration camp. She was taken as a very young girl and was able to escape very early before the Nazis got their act together. So she was extraordinarily fortunate. But this was when she was 13. And by the way, I have to say something, which is her parents, who were educated, well-to-do in Vienna, waited too long. And they were sure that things couldn't really get that bad. And of course, that haunts me now. I have a daughter and I wonder, how do you know when things are so bad that you need to leave? And it's so hard to tell.
It's a transgenerational legacy, really.
Yeah. So I feel I'm still haunted by the mistake that my grandparents made in Vienna. But at any rate, she survived. My father's family astonishingly went through a similar level of trauma with a similar loss of life, but in this case in pogroms in the Ukraine, not the Nazis. And they met here, and when I was born, they wanted to, I think, flee to the farthest place they could that still had a good university. I think that's sort of like this Jewish thing, maybe. So we ended up in southern New Mexico and also in West Texas right at the start. And I would, as you said, I could choose. I had an interesting multicultural life. In those days, the border between the U.S. and Mexico was really sweet. It was kids took school buses across all the time to go to schools on the other side. And it was Mexico was this place that in some ways was more advanced than us. The schools were better.
No, but you were living in a geodesic dome. You were living the Bucky Fuller dream life.
That was a little later. What happened is my mom died in a car accident. And after that, she had been the breadwinner. She was really unusual that way. She was ahead of her time. She made her money on the phone with stocks. And my dad was never a breadwinner. And we had no money after she died. And we ended up living on just desert land and in tents and gradually building a house that my dad let me design rather foolishly, it turned out, because part of it collapsed later. But we did build this house that was all these crazy shapes, including geodesic domes, but also some other things. We started building it when I was around 11, and we finished it around the time I was 17. Yeah.
Let me go back to virtual reality and in terms of your development, because for you, it really started and proliferated in the 80s. It's a very different phenomenon now. And I mean, never the twain, right?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's not that different. If you buy some of the consumer VR systems now, It's not that different for what we were selling for millions of dollars in the 80s, because what we would do back then is we would take these things that were extraordinarily expensive and applied for different industrial purposes. I mentioned surgical simulation, but we were also doing vehicle prototyping and all kinds of other things. And of course, we made our own fun stuff in the middle of the night, and we made all kinds of unusual experiences. Not so much gaming, I have to say, but other things. And these days, if you download some of the more unusual stuff and you put on some of the commercial headsets, it's not that different of an experience. The graphics are a little better than they were, much, 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 much cheaper. The interaction, the ability to pick up stuff and manipulate it, is not as good as it used to be. It used to be much more interesting and better. And the social aspect, the degree to which you can share with other people, isn't as good as it used to be. That used to be a lot more interesting. But they're comparable. Like, I mean, you put on one of these things and it feels similar. It feels like a continuity.
What moved you into that field? I mean, when I read about your background, and it was rich culturally. I mean, you know, you're a man who is known also for a lot that you've done in music and painting. And I mean, you're a real Renaissance Spencerian man, we used to call you. not stroking you, just, you know, who you are.
Whenever somebody says, hey, you're a Renaissance man, I point out that the real Renaissance men were also athletes. And I don't think I can qualify for
all
that.
All right, we'll give you some slack on that.
Yeah, let's...
But the reality is, I know you've got like over 1,000 instruments, around 1,000 instruments,
well,
and you've done a lot of composing and so forth.
Yeah.
So where's the branch to virtual reality?
Well, what happened was when I was a kid, I had this profound feeling of loneliness, especially when my mother died. I used to think of other people very much like the stars in the sky at night, like so distant that you can sort of see them, but you could never reach them. I thought of these other people's heads as like these distant orbs with mysteries inside that I could never connect to. And I had this experience as a little kid of staring at surrealist art like Hieronymus Bosch and feeling like, you know, there's something about art where people can create these things that aren't real, and yet they still connect. And that's the channel to these distant orbs. And I dreamed of some kind of way of sharing surreal experiences. I had this vivid sense that that's what I needed. And when I was a teenager and I read a paper by Ivan Sutherland, the man I mentioned who made the first VR headset, I got so excited that I would just take a mimeograph of it, which is the way we copied things in those days. This was in the 70s. And I'd run up to strangers on the street because there wasn't any internet yet. And I would just say, you've got to see this. We're going to share dreams. And they would like, who is this weird kid? Get him away. But I had this very vivid sense that this was a path. So it was like this... this thing that I just immediately knew was important that I had to do. So one of these crazy stories. And in the early 80s,
it was the stars in the sky that inspired. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in New Mexico, you see them, you know. And in the early 80s, I made some money from video games in the 8-bit era. And just took the cash, and some friends and I lived in these falling down bungalows in a dirt road in Palo Alto, the sort of place that certainly doesn't exist anymore. And we just...
Nor are there any more falling down bungalows in Palo Alto.
Well, if there are any, we wouldn't be able to afford them now. And we just started building these things. We just did it. We didn't ask anyone for permission. We just started building.
Talking with Jaron Lanier, he's the author, he's an author and a computer scientist. His latest book is Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. You've also become kind of, a bit of an Old Testament prophet in some ways, is the way I might characterize it, in addition to the Renaissance man without the athletic motivation. I'm thinking about the fact that you've gone on record talking about Silicon Valley a lot and talking about how negative emotion particularly has... held sway over positive emotions too much. I know you're optimistic fundamentally, but that whole sense of, I mean, for example, you've been talking about the Me Too movement and saying this is going really well now maybe, but it's going to turn because we've seen so many of these things turn.
Well, you know, I think it's healthy and necessary and an obligation to see the dark side of the technologies we're making, and it doesn't in any way contradict idealism or even utopianism. We have to take in the whole spectrum. We have to be honest with ourselves. And sometimes I've gotten a lot of heat from people in Silicon Valley about that because I've been doing it for many, many years. These days, so many other people are criticizing Silicon Valley that I might be immoderate in my criticism in comparison to some. But the way I see it is we started with this idea that everything on the internet should be free, code and music and news and everything, but we didn't want it to be socialism. We didn't want it to be free in the sense that it's some government thing that doles it out. Instead, we wanted high-tech entrepreneurs. We love Steve Jobs. We love Bill Gates. Well, they love Bill Gates maybe at the time more in Seattle than here, but whatever. We love Steve Jobs, at least down here. And we ended up with this solution, which is the advertising model, where you can get stuff for free, but you get advertisements. And the problem is that between Moore's Law, where the computers keep on getting better, and then advances and machine learning and all that, and just commercial pressure, and then just the scale of the internet, what used to be advertising has morphed into this other thing, which I call behavior modification empire. So, you know, and so now we have the situation where when you use an online service, it's gathering all the data about you, but it's also customizing your feed in order to manipulate you subtly, and the terms of the manipulation aren't even created by the Silicon Valley companies, but by whatever third party is paying or even not paying to manipulate the system. And
which is why you'd like to see a fee, I guess.
Let me get to that in a second. So what we've discovered now is what I think everybody knew, but it's out in the open, that a lot of this stuff is really dark and malicious. Like Black Lives Matter is a good clear example, where you had, in my view, a very positive movement. I thought Black Lives Matter was a very positive and even generous formulation of a very difficult situation. But what happens is the algorithms naturally take whatever goes into it, it's, let's say, positive energy, and tries to use it as fuel to get as much engagement and as much bang for the buck for advertisers, so-called advertisers. I'd rather call them manipulators, but it has to monetize as much as possible. And just to get that, the negative emotions are always going to be more monetizable, more intense, more sustainable.
Just like political campaigns.
Sure. Like negative stuff just is intense. We naturally...
So Black Lives Matter gives birth to the white racism.
So what happens is the algorithms find all the people who are upset by Black Lives Matter, introduces them to each other, puts them in a feedback loop to make it more and more intense, because engagement is the prime directive, you know? And so then you have these countervailing things that come out of positivity that are overwhelmingly more negative, and it keeps on happening. It happened to the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring started off with these cute, idealistic kids and turned into social media being used for horrible atrocity generation.
And use the example of Gamergate, yeah.
Gamergate's another great example. Yeah. You had women, I think, very reasonably trying to improve the gaming world in on many dimensions, and giving fuel to this horrible, horrible, deathly nihilistic reaction in Gamergate. It just happens over and over again with many examples. And so I think we just have to admit that this idea. So, and right now, look, what's going on in Iran? You see Iranians using social media to organize protests. I have an inner voice where I'm thinking, yes, 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 the Iranian government tries to shut down social media, but the good-hearted activists will route around it. Like, I still have that old program running in my head, even though we've seen again and again that after a while it turns against itself and turns horrible. It doesn't work. Like, you can't have these behavior modification empires for rent to whoever uses them and then expect that to create positive social change. It's just impossible. So,
well, if the negative is more monetizable, there's a word that doesn't exist, and there's darkness in the algorithm, what do we do about it? Is there a way to positivize this?
I'll just make a couple of observations. One is if you give people anything other than mind games and status games to seek online, they'll prefer that thing. And so, like, I might sound biased because I'm associated with it professionally, but you don't see all of the malicious fake news and horrible attacks and all that on LinkedIn, which is a local big social network, or locally based big social network. And the reason why is people have something else to do. They're furthering careers, and the careers they're furthering aren't some giant contest for popularity like on social media, but instead they're individual. They're not directly opposed to one another. They're not all fungible with each other. So you suddenly have civilization and you have decency appear. But another thing I've been really interested in is monetizing this thing. Like, what if we were wrong of trying to make everything free with advertising? What if you just paid a little money every month to use something like Facebook? Just, you know, you pay some money for Netflix and that created peak TV. What if you actually paid Facebook a little money and then maybe Facebook would even pay you if you were an exceptional contributor? And if that happened, maybe we'd have peak social media. Suddenly it might get better the same way that TV got better when we were willing to pay for it. Like, why not try that? So I'm really interested in monetizing.
And you think Me Too movement is going to go the same way that these other things have gone?
I hope not. I mean, I just think if we look at the evidence so far, there's good reason to worry. I always want to look out for and believe in the better scenario, but we have to be realists about how many failures there have been.
Let me give out the phone number. This is certainly a topic that some of you may indeed want to weigh in on. But if you have questions about virtual reality or anything you'd like to talk about, I invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. And you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. And any questions or comments you might have for our guest, Jaron Lanier, again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. There are other ways to join us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and post your questions or comments there, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I'm talking about really some of the more positive sides, as well as creepy, to use Jaron's word here, sides of internet or of virtual reality. And I know, at least I suspect, many of you may have some strong opinions you want to voice here, so please feel free to do that. A couple of just quick questions. You could still do a VR Olympics? Is that still in the plans?
Oh, yeah. This is a story from the 80s about an exploration we did with the Olympics movement about potential athletics in VR. It was way premature then. I have no idea if anybody's trying to do that now. I think it's worth it, though. I think it would be an interesting thing to do.
Coming up on a break, but I also have to ask you, because there's very much in the news, all this talk about digital disappearing. It's a fragile system. What do you think?
Wait, which thing?
That eventually the digital age that we're in is not going to be there. It's simply evanescent, let's say.
Yeah, I think some kind of connected computational thing for people is necessary. If we didn't have a global network, we wouldn't even be able to follow the course of something like global climate change or epidemics. I mean, we need this for survival. It's not an option. And it also can be quite beautiful. But whether we've gotten the right start or not, we just don't know yet.
And virtual reality is still being pressured by what you call the psychedelic people?
No, I think there's a little bit of psychedelic spirit in the virtual reality movement, but there's not as much a direct connection as there once was.
All right, when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners, who are talking this hour with Jaron Lanier. He's the author of a new book called Dawn of the New Everything: Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Jaron Lanier. He's here with us in studio, Bay Area author and computer scientist who's the author of a number of books. The newest one is called Dawn of New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. And he's one of those people who could be called, I think, appropriately a pioneer, if not maybe by some lights, the pioneer of virtual reality. Also talking about just how much we are manipulated by, well, the technology age we live in, and by the internet, and by particularly worlds like Google and Facebook, and the good and bad sides of technology. What pleases you about technology? What worries you most about technology? You certainly have an opportunity here to weigh in and join our conversation. You can do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways you can indeed become a part of the program. Let me go to a caller in Berkeley. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Jaron. Great show. And by the way, I loved your book, You Are Not a Gadget. It's been very influential, and I'm looking forward to reading some of your more current stuff.
Thank you.
My question is about cryptocurrency and some of the newer alternative cryptocurrencies that are coming out and how you see them impacting our online experience, in particular, perhaps Substratum, which is tackling the net neutrality problem from a technology perspective. Your thoughts would be really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, well, just it's a huge topic, so I'm just going to do a super compressed answer, if that's okay. The general cryptocurrency idea that you can use algorithms as a way to get people to coordinate and overcome kind of human orneriness, you know, like using algorithms instead of government, maybe can work. But generally, people find ways to pervert algorithms. You know, they find ways to sneak around things and challenge them. And so I think the overall impulse and the program might be flawed. I think we might just actually have to learn to get along and coordinate. And we might not be able to rely on algorithms as much as we might dream of. And then, but you know, if it works, that's great. I think it's an experiment that's really worthy. There are two specific comments about the current crop of cryptocurrencies. One is, if you're using computational inefficiency as the basis of your civilization, you damn well better put your servers on the moon or something, because we're roasting the planet as it is, and that's problematic. So I think a lot of people have noticed that issue finally. And then also, why are so many of the new cryptocurrencies, and especially the best-known ones, Ponzi schemes fundamentally? Like, in theory, you can make these in such a way that they're not a Ponzi scheme, but they seem to always be Ponzi schemes because people have like these dreams of instant wealth. And I just don't think civilization can afford too many more high-tech Ponzi schemes. We have to deponzify the cryptocurrencies if they're going to be useful. So that's my really quick.
There's a new word to add to your lexicon, deponzify.
That's right.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go right to another caller, and that's you, Minnell from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. Nice to talk to you, Jaron Lanier. I have a really quick question. There's a philosopher named Slavoj Žižek who's talked about your concept of authenticity online and how using pseudonyms is perhaps not the best thing to do.
Could I ask you, can you follow him? I mean, he's one of the most brilliant, but in many ways, how shall I put this, opaque kind of philosophers we have around us. Fascinating guy, though. Yeah.
But you know what? I really appreciate somebody becoming a celebrity with different
with philosophy.
Philosophy. You know, whatever you think of him personally, I really am glad he's there.
Yeah, so am I. I don't mean to put him down. I've had him on the air. But, you know, and there's a brilliance there. There's a kind of almost paranormal.
Anyway, what's the question?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so he talks, I think he responded in a talk he gave to your concept of using one's real name online and how that might prevent trolling and the like, but his psychoanalytic take on it was that using one's pseudonym, that mask that you put on online is, in a sense, more real than using your own name online, because then you don't have all these social pressures that you're dealing with. I was just wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
If he said, I wasn't aware that he'd said that, but if that's so, he misunderstood me. The point isn't so much to have your true natural name or your true legal name, but to have a persistent, if you like, legal and fiscal presence. I think what this gets to is whether you can own your own value online. And it's there's a question of whether the value you bring to the world is being slurped up by some higher platform that's taking your data and monetizing it and demonetizing you, or if you're in some post-money world in the future, taking away your power and making itself more powerful. Like the key point I'm trying to make here is that individuals have to be able to accrue some kind of – I use the word clout to avoid the term capital, because this isn't necessarily about money as we understand it. But you have to be able to build up your own clout. You have to be a first-class citizen in the world. And so what I'm getting at here is that fungible personas have been used to de-empower people because of the way platforms work, and that's the thing that's not survivable. So not having read what he said, I can't really comment on it, but based on your description, I suspect it's a misunderstanding.
But this is a big question. I remember many years ago, I'm sure you know Stuart Brand, founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, and he started The Well, which was one of the first, ways of communicating now what we have in the internet. And we talked about this whole phenomenon because it started out of what are called trolls. I mean, people who just use the internet for outlets or these communal ways of communicating, outlets of hostility, mm-hmm. you know, typical thing, guy in his pajamas down in his room alone or whatever. there's almost an archetype there.
Yeah.
But Stewart said, this is the one phenomenon I can't understand. I mean, a lot of it has to do, he said, and we agreed with anonymity, like a car, you're driving in a car, you get road rage, that sort of thing. But it's still a phenomenon, and it's a phenomenon that's difficult to understand.
Yeah, it appeared really early, like in Usenet in the 80s. There was this thing that happened, and you know, people just would be in an open forum talking about something, and everybody would turn into a creep. Everyone would start playing power games. They'd become cruel. They'd turn into little kids on a playground or people in high school or something. And I felt it in myself. I mean, I felt what I call my inner troll rising up, and it was really strange. It was like invoked out of nowhere. And I have some theories about it.
Love to hear, because you do theorize a lot, and this is, I think, a significant thing to talk about.
It's a big topic. The super quick version is, I think that people are kind of like wolves. We can either be loners or we can be in packs. And when you're in a pack, instead of directly encountering reality, you become more concerned with the pack dynamics. And then you're always both trying to please and potentially trying to overcome the people above you in the hierarchy. And you're dumping on the people below you because that's your guarantee of not being dumped on yourself when you gang up on those mm-hmm. below you. And then you have a shared hatred of other packs. There's this whole thing that comes about.
It's tribal.
Yeah. And so the goal of civilization should be to make that switch stay in the individual instead of the pack position as often as possible. Once in a while, it probably has to be in the pack position if you're in a military unit or something. But in general, we should try to keep it individual. And I think what happens in these open forums is, since the only thing that's available is mind games, you're demonetized. You're just like this little peon in somebody else's platform. All that's left is the pack dynamics, and so it brings that out in people, and that's the troll. And I think the way around it is just to give people something else to work towards. It's not mind games. Like, either if it's monetized, they can be earning money. If it's some way to further something else that's real for them, like LinkedIn does with careers, just something else to do, I think people will choose to keep the switch in the individual position.
Yeah, you have a lot of faith in individual sublimation, I think, or something along those lines, that individuals will pursue what they want to pursue.
Well, the thing is, if you don't believe in individuals, then a ton of other stuff collapses. It's not just because I'm an idealistic American. Like, if what you believe in is markets, unless you have individuals with separate perspectives and intellects and backgrounds, the idea of a market doesn't do anything, because the whole point of capitalism is to bring together all these differences that compete. And if people lose their differences because they're being controlled by advertisers over social network, the market no longer makes sense. It's a fake. Same thing from democracy. If that's what you believe in, you have to have separation between individuals and genuine individuality for voting to mean anything. Otherwise, it's a fake. And so I think, like, you know, all of these systems ultimately depend on real individuals at their core, or else they just don't mean anything. So I don't see how you can believe in any of these structures without first believing in individuals.
Let me bring some more of your calls on. We go next to you, Stanford. You're on the air. Good morning.
What is the future of assistive technology? How do you envision that?
Of systems?
Assistive.
Assistive. I'm a little bit of a certain poll. Look down 10, 20 years down the line. What's on the horizon for independence?
There was just a little bit of distortion. Do you mean assistive as in helping people who have disabilities, or do you mean like personal assistance like Cortana or something?
Well, I think in certain scenarios they're one and the same, but for people with disabilities.
Yeah. Oh, okay, great. So, you know, in my view, disabilities-related work has been the cutting edge and the best of user interface development, and therefore the best of computing, because that's really where we start to pay attention to people's individuality and what actually works for people, instead of some hypothetical generic person. And so, in a sense, they're the best engineers in computer science, in my view, and it's the most important cutting edge. And what I hope we evolve to eventually is a recognition that each person is unique, that each interface for a person should be as good as possible for that person, and that the success of that person is the only meaning of the computer technology at all. There's no other purpose for it. And so we essentially the whole thing should be assistive technology. There should, you know, so I think that pursuing that is one of the most fruitful things you can do in technology.
And we thank you for the call, Stanford. Here's Judy, who wants to know, why would monetization of social media evolve any better than the path we now see with Citizens United?
I know this is embarrassing. There's just been so much political stuff. I don't remember what Citizens United is.
It just allows for whatever amount of money people want to donate.
Oh, right. It's a horrible Supreme Court decision. Sorry. There's been such a tremendous boatload of crap from Washington lately that it's hard to keep it straight, even basic stuff.
You get slack on that, just like the physical stuff. You're too much of a polymath.
The thing about monetization is that potentially it's an incredible empowerment for individuals if it's done fairly and if it's not fake, because it gives people parity within a marketplace. It makes people into first-class citizens. It's a lot of what led to the spread of decent middle-class emphasizing societies in the post-war period in the last century. Now, of course, it can also turn into a tool for plutocracy and concentration of oligarch power, which is what you're talking about. So it doesn't provide any guarantee. It's totally corruptible. In my view, beggars can't be choosers here. There are very few things that have worked out well for society in history. There are very few examples where we can point to something and say, wow, society got more decent for some sustained period when this was done. And if I look at periods that are relatively decent, that seem to have at least a little bit of staying power, that weren't just flashes in the pan, middle classes where people had some of their own capital and some of their own clout seemed to fit the bill. And I tend to think it worked best in social democracies and in Europe, maybe, but it also worked here remarkably so. So I'm just trying to build on what successes we've seen, and we honestly haven't seen a lot of them. So that's the reason why I go there.
Let's go to some more calls, and let's welcome Wayoku. Good morning.
Wayaka.
I'm sorry.
Tricky one. Hi, good morning.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're having this conversation. I really enjoy listening. My comment is about social media and Facebook. One of the things that I have noticed, and I'll preface this by saying that I taught kindergarten for 25 years, so I taught children how to communicate with one another. And I have noticed, and myself included, that with Facebook, it gives us such a false sense of connectedness, and I feel like we begin to depend on that, and we've become really lazy in terms of actually reaching out and having a true connection with people, because we've just become a society of instant gratification, and I think that Facebook absolutely lends itself to that. While I think it's a great forum for certain things, I think it's just like a basic human condition where we just go to extremes. And I think that we've stopped just picking up the phone and calling each other, writing letters to one another, meeting each other in places, because we've become lazy. It's much easier just to pop on Facebook and get some kind of idea of what our friends are doing across the country. And I just don't think it's real. Mm. And
it's not. It's virtual.
Yeah, it's totally virtual, and also I just think that we're depending on it, and we seem to think that we're really staying connected with one another, when in fact we're not. If that's our main form of checking in with one another.
Thank you for those thoughts. I'm appreciative of them. So, there are a lot of folks who think, Zuckerberg, all this talk about connectivity, and we're going to save the world with this because everybody will be connected and so forth. There are these darker sides. She's pointed certainly to one of them, but also the came up in the last election, too, how Facebook can be manipulated again and was manipulated.
Yeah, I sometimes call it a personal hypnotist who's actually working for a third party that you don't get to know about. You know, it is a little, it's creepy, it's scary.
I ask you about something else that occurred to me. I was at a New Year's dinner, and a friend of mine who is a photographer, not by profession, but has found photography to be a good escape during his retirement, was talking about all the new technology he's applied to photographs. And his wife was saying, I don't like that. I like the photographs to not be touched up, to not be worked through with the new technology. There's a sense of purist in that. And she said, I don't like to shop on the internet. I like to go in a store. And I'm thinking about all this, you know, just in terms of the division that we're living in now. It's a virtual division between what's real and what's not. The nice thing about virtual reality is you can mix the two. I understand that. But.
Well, my favorite thing about virtual reality is the moment when you take off the headset and you perceive reality anew, because in the contrast, your senses are freshened and you can perceive physical reality as the miracle that it is, as the thing with infinite depth. And with the, it's just extraordinary. I used to sometimes sneak a flower in front of somebody while they were in the headset, and then you'd see somebody stare at this flower. And it really opens the senses.
Pam writes, here's an alternative to the monetization problem. How about trying to find a tech version of Andrew Carnegie who could create a free, public, user-controlled social media platform? Know anybody you could persuade?
Well, you know, the problem with free is that we're also anti-tax, anti-government. You know, I'm actually not idealistic about any particular thing. If somebody wants to go for capitalism, I'm game. If somebody wants to go for socialism, I'm game to give it a try. But what we have is this weird hybrid. You know, in finance, it's the socialization of risk and the privatization of reward, right? But in social media, it's the socialization of content and energy and human activity, and it's the privatization of profit. And if you do that, you end up with this manipulation society, the society of stealth, sneaky manipulators. So, like, you know, like we it's the blend that kills you. You know, we have to really figure out some system that makes sense as a whole.
Here's Julie, who writes, I work in the tech industry teaching. I and most of my students are single mothers, and I struggle with what to tell them when they ask me how to protect their kids from the creepy parts of VR and technology. Any insights?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to be facing this pretty soon myself because I have an 11-year-old. A lot of my friends in the tech world don't let their kids anywhere near the stuff that we make our living from. It's kind of freaky. Like, there are a lot of high-tech kids kids of Silicon Valley in Waldorf schools and things like that. I'm trying to chart a middle course, and I wish I had some perfect formula for you. I think all of us have to struggle with this, and I don't think any of us will get it perfect during these years.
You know, it bothers me, the fact that that neural pathways are probably being changed, don't you think?
Well, there are a couple of things that I just can't believe people are doing, like to let a little kid talk to a talking speaker. That's just like some crappy.
Plus, you can go on and get any kind of pornography. You can go on and get all kinds of really vivid imagery of the most horrific sort of things imaginable.
Yeah. What I worry about, oh, God, see, there are a lot of different things that can go wrong. So, on my personal list, the worst thing is when a kid has an account and then the feed for the kid is customized in a way that serves the interests of unseen third parties. So by that standard, if the talking speaker is run by a company that's selling you something like Amazon, it might be a little less creepy than one that's just selling whatever some third party might come along to sell that other companies might offer without dumping on anybody. But then what you say is absolutely true. There are these horrific things, and I've already encountered both my kid and others who've been traumatized by things they run across. And a decent society is one where people have a stake, and this idea of this totally open and free thing where people have no stake other than manipulating each other just brings out the worst in people. And I think that we brought it about on ourselves, and a lot of the motivation was initially very sweet and kind of innocent, but we've got to recognize that it's not working.
Well, where were the pioneers in all this? I mean, you know, we talk about bullying now on the internet, and it's just standard practice that kids will commit suicide because they're being bullied on the internet.
Yeah.
Or we talk about the fact that we don't have the privatization that we all want and we all had hoped for and so forth. I mean, There was no, it was like, not, we used to talk about the superhighway and there was all this excitement, everybody, nobody saw what was around the corners.
No, we did see it. That's the thing, is that a lot of us were writing warnings about this stuff from way back. You mentioned Norbert Wiener, who actually warned about our current situation fairly specifically in a book called The Human Use of Human Beings. And at the end of it, he comments that there never could be a global information system where everybody carries around devices that could present them with customized stimulus that would always be connected by radio. It's inconceivable. So this is only a thought experiment. But of course, we've created it. And if you want to really go back, Forster's The Machine Stops from 1907, I think, also describes this dystopia that we've created in real life. So there have been lots of warnings. And in the 80s and 90s, both me and other people, even people like Stuart Brand and other people, you know, were very very interested in these negative scenarios, and there were wonderfully articulate things written.
And you know, it could get worse. I mean, you know, Gary Steingart is a very funny novelist.
Yeah, sure.
He had a futuristic novel where, you know, people suddenly, they have devices, and you go into a singles bar, and you can not only tell what somebody's medical history is, I mean, despite HIPAA laws and all the rest of it, mm-hmm. you get all this information that just goes into private lives in ways that, you know, were unprecedented and simply unimagined. And it's out there for
well,
the
see,
grab.
There's there's a sort of digital version of the male gaze where there's this fantasy that you get this information popping around a woman at a bar where all this, you have privileged information. But the thing is that that's a fake, because the party with the real privileged information will always be at the central server that's running the scheme. So, you're not actually getting the real information. You're getting some secondary, semi-valuable information, but not the good stuff. You're being manipulated along with the woman you're looking at. And the thing is that there's this fantasy that somehow you're on top, and that drives the whole thing. But it's a fake. It's not real.
Have you read Emily Chang? She was in Vanity Fair, and she's got a book out about all of the manipulation that goes on in Silicon Valley.
I've read the Vanity Fair thing. I haven't read the book.
I mean, and I know you've talked about the need for cognitive diversity in Silicon Valley, which is lacking because of the cost of housing. It's too expensive. But, you know, aside from that, you know, you've got this whole phenomenon now of Emily Chang writes about it, about like if people want to do venture capital and everything, they have to go to these sex and drug parties and all the rest.
Well, there's a long history in the Bay Area of some sort of a crossover between people interested in taking MDMA and having weird sex parties and some combination thereof, and people in the tech world. It seems to me that what's different lately is bringing in I'm not sure what language I can use on air, so I'm trying to check.
No profanity, please. We just cut
but
you one before.
There's this certain kind of hyper interest in money and status games, and this kind of intense insecurity that, like, if I can't have sex, if I'm not respected, I'm nothing. It's like this kind of insecurity in some of the young men in the tech business that I don't think used to exist. I don't remember us being quite like that, and so. And I think it's this blending of what's a Bay Area tradition with this new kind of, I think what she calls brotopia. And I think in a way it might make things worse for women in Silicon Valley even than they used to be. But I have to say, like, at this point in my life, I don't have any direct connection to that sort of thing. So I can't say for sure. Last night, my wife asked me if I've gone to any of these parties, and I was like, yeah, well, no, I can only go by Skype at this point because I'm a middle-aged guy, you know, so it's not going to happen. But
well, here's a listener who says, how do you figure that social media is at fault for the backlash against Black Lives Matter and feminist gamers? Status quo defending backlash against progressive movements is a constant historical pattern.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And what I've been interested in, though, is that in the past, the backlashes might have been at a comparable scale to the initial thing. And overall, there was a two steps forward, one step back kind of a pattern where gradually you could discern an arc in history. And lately, what's happened is that the backlashes have been a vastly greater magnitude, and they seem to come out of the social media world. And they're not only vaster, they're almost unimaginably cruel and horrible. And that is actually different.
Part of that backlash, Trump's election?
Yeah, sure. It does seem to me that, and this is all over the world, it's not just the U.S., we see democracies under the influence of social media, often with foreign meddling, dumping their own self-interests. We see the rise of strongmen and autocracies and autocrats and plutocrats and oligarchs in countries as diverse as Austria and Turkey. And I mean, it used to be that when democracy started in a country, it seemed to last, it seemed to increase. And just recently, that's not true anymore. And so, you know, when something seems to be a trend, when there seems to be an arc of history, and then the arc crashes, you have to ask what's different. And it does appear to me that our mode of connecting with each other is a lot of what's different.
All right, so we got a minute left, and a listener wants to know, if you were designing the internet today, what would you do to make it work better?
Oh, gosh. I'd go back to the original design for digital networks, Ted Nelson's work of 1960, and make two-way links so you could always tell where something came from. Instead of people losing context to third-party platforms, they'd have their own context. Then they'd be able to be paid. They'd be more in charge of who they are. They'd have more stake in the game. So two-way links would be my number one thing.
And number two and three?
Number two would be monetization. Number three would be a persistent identity service that's global and, if you like, government instead of in private hands that aren't yours.
Always good to have you aboard here, Jaron. Thank you. Appreciate you being with us.
I am so happy to be with you again.
And again, Jaron Lanier's new book is called The Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, and 10 to 11 in the evening. Inform is produced by Judy Campbell, Jeremy Siegel, Tina Larber, Katie Springer, and Penny Nielsen. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Devin Holt and Amanda Font. Interns are Patrick Fitzgerald. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.